Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the second in the 2012 series of the Centre for Public Policy Public Forums. We've had a great deal of interest in this event, so there will be people coming in after we've started, but I just wanted to make sure that we started reasonably promptly. As we begin, I would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, who are the traditional custodians of this land, and pay respect to the elders, both past and present, of the Kulin Nation, and extend that respect to any other Indigenous Australians present. My name is Helen Sullivan. I'm Professor and Director of the Centre for Public Policy here at the University of Melbourne. Those of you on the Centre for Public Policy mailing list will be familiar with me from my monthly blogs, and I'm very grateful to all of you who take the time and trouble to respond and tell me where I'm right or where I'm wrong and what we should be doing. To those of you not yet on the Centre for Public Policy mailing list, please do think about joining it. That way you get prior notification of our events and also have an opportunity to participate in our online conversations. All it takes is an email address, which you can leave with us, or you can register via the website. And at this point, I want to just flag for you our next event will be on the 1st of May and will feature the Chief Justice, Marilyn Warren. All of that brings me to tonight's theme, which is talking about racism, equality and social cohesion in Australia. The discussion will be led by Dr. Helen Suzuki, who's the Race Discrimination Commissioner on the Australian Human Rights Commission. And the respondent will be Dr. Milsom Henry Waring, who's a senior lecturer here in sociology at the University of Melbourne. And I just want to say a little bit by way of introduction, although I'm very well aware that Helen Suzuki is known to many of you. I've been in Australia for 6 months now, and Helen was one of the first people I met, and she's been, apart from being hugely impressive individually, she's made a great deal of time to talk to me about her experience in the past of the centre and what we might be doing in the future, and she's a great advisor to have on hand. Helen was appointed as Australia's full-time Race Discrimination Commissioner in September 2011 for a 5-year term. Prior to this, she was the Commissioner for the Victorian Equal Opportunity and Human Rights Commission between 2004 and 2011. She's held positions in a range of public service and not-for-profit organisations. She's currently a board member of Multicultural Arts Victoria, a member of the Advisory Committee for the Centre for International Mental Health at the University of Melbourne, and a patron of New Beginnings, a collaboration between Sudanese and non-Sudanese Australians to break cycles of conflict, and patron of the Australian Arabic Women's Foundation. She's leading the development of Australia's national anti-racism strategy, which aims to promote a clear understanding in the Australian community of what racism is and how it can be prevented and reduced. The Australian government committed to developing a national anti-racism strategy as part of Australia's multicultural policy, the People of Australia. It's anticipated that the strategy will be launched in July of this year and implemented between 2012 and 2015. And public consultations about that strategy have already begun. And we see this event as a continuation of that consultation, as well as a broader discussion. Dr. Milsom Henry Waring, our respondent, is Discipline Chair and Senior Lecturer in Sociology at the University here. She's one of the Joint Chief Investigators on the Australian Research Council Linkage Project, Resettling Visible Migrants and Refugees in Rural and Regional Australia, which is conducted in partnership with a range of organisations, including the Municipal Association of Victoria and the Office of Multicultural Affairs and Citizenship in the Victorian Department of Premier and Cabinet. And this project aims to examine the interrelated social, economic and political factors that shape the resettlement experiences of recently arrived and arguably more visible migrants and refugees living primarily in rural and regional areas. Milsom joined the university in February 2003, and prior to that, she was based in the UK. Her research and teaching interests are based around notions of visibility, difference, otherness, blackness and whiteness, specifically in the areas of identity, intimacy, popular culture, new technologies, nationalism and multiculturalism. So we have two expert speakers for this evening's theme, and the format's going to be as follows. Helen will speak first for about 40 minutes or so, and Milsom will then offer a response for between 15 and 20 minutes. We'll then open the discussion for questions, comments, however you want to take it, and think about the implications of what the speakers have said for strategy, policy and action. And at the end of the session this evening, there will be a small reception, so you are very welcome to stay for that and to continue the conversation. So without further ado, I would like to welcome Dr. Helen Suzuki to come and give the opening address. Helen.
Thanks very much, and thanks for giving your time tonight. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and to pay respects to elders past and present. And I'd also, mainly because it will be excruciatingly embarrassing for her, I'd like to acknowledge my ex-colleague Karen Toohey, who's the acting Victorian Equal Opportunity and Human Rights Commissioner, and who is leading some amazing work in the racism space in the Victorian context. So we live in interesting times, as the Chinese proverb says, and we wonder about the next wave of economic challenges. We look at the two-speed economy in Australia, the labour market shortages in some areas and high pockets of unemployment in others. And what we know is that when the going gets tough, the tough gets going. And it means, from my perspective, that we have to be even more vigilant in monitoring social cohesion indicators in our country. One of the big elephants in the room, I think, is the question of population and how this impacts on the future prosperity of Australia. It also impacts on how we maintain and protect social cohesion. We are fortunate that we do not face the same level of social unrest as we see in many other parts of the world, and it's certainly a characteristic of Australian society that should be cherished. I touch on this not because I want to particularly explore in great detail the issue of the population size of Australia, but because I think it raises the spectre of many issues that I will face, either directly or indirectly, in rolling out a national anti-racism strategy. The development of the strategy is not just about how we are currently travelling, but about anticipating the likely opportunities and obstacles we will face and charting the best course through them. Tonight I want to explore a couple of issues. Let's start with the macro and the future, and what we want to be considered in the future when we look at the economic and social prosperity of Australia in relation to population. I'd then like to explore some aspects of social cohesion and equality and look at what it achieves to what it takes to achieve those ends, and I want to share a couple of stories with you along the way. So if we look first of all at multiculturalism, multiculturalism is no longer a social experiment, it's the norm. We live in a world in which physical distance is less and less of a barrier to connecting people across the world. We can no longer consider ourselves the isolated island we once were. Figures suggest that Australia is reliant on immigration for our continued growth and prosperity. If we look at just one sector that's familiar to many in the audience here, tertiary education is Australia's third largest export income. And in 2009, it generated $18.6 billion and sustained around 125,000 jobs. If we're prepared to accept the benefits of a migrant economy, we must ensure that we meet the basic human rights of all who partake in it. We already have the guidelines for what we need to do that. They're clearly set out in a number of conventions and declarations that Australia has ratified, not the least of which is the Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. They include the right to security of person and protection by the state against violence or bodily harm, the right to free choice of employment, to just favourable work conditions of work, to protection against unemployment, to equal pay for equal work, to just and favourable remuneration. They include the right to housing and the right to public health, medical care, social security and social services. Unfortunately, Australia's policies and infrastructure are not always equipped to meet these rights for culturally diverse communities. And if I give you just two examples, evidence suggests that a number of real estate agencies now have policies that automatically reject rental applications from people who have obtained bond loans. The rationale for doing this is that people who require financial assistance to pay a bond are more likely to default on rent payments. However, the practical effect of that policy is that those with the greatest socioeconomic barriers, such as Indigenous Australians and refugee families, are virtually being blacklisted from obtaining decent housing. The second example that I would give is in relation to employer-sponsored visa holders who are quite vulnerable to work exploitation precisely because of their reliance on their employer's support to remain in Australia. And you may recall the federal court case last year of a Perth employer who was found to have paid five Chinese construction workers $3 per hour to work 10 to 11 hour shifts at least 6 days a week. And four of the men were not paid at all for the first 3 months of their employment. These are the kind of issues that we will continue to grapple with unless there are effective strategies put in place to cope with the growing population. The sustainable population strategy is an important tool for addressing these challenges, and I sincerely hope that activities aimed at improving the delivery of social services and housing, which have been funded under this strategy, will continue beyond this budget. In whatever future form the strategy does take, we need to continue to consider how this work can feed into other developing policies, such as the social inclusion agenda, the national anti-racism strategy included as well. Our work will only be strengthened by better cross-government collaboration. Now, if we turn to the issue of racism, it's true to say that our time since white settlement has quite obviously racist overtones. It's also true to say that prior to white settlement, the continent that we now call Australia was in fact multicultural, with many different First Nations people living across the vast expanse of the land. In order to work towards equality and social cohesion, I contend that we have to admit that racism acts as a barrier to achieving these goals. As a country, we have a strong commitment to equality, but we also have to understand that to be vigilant about equality, we have to identify the barriers to equality. In other areas of gender, we've done this quite positively. The institutional, systemic, and overt barriers to women achieving equality are well understood, if not well grappled with. To some extent, we've done this with disability and age. We can name the discrimination when it occurs, and by naming it, we know how to address it. Race, however, is a different kettle of fish. We're often frightened to call racism when we see it, and there are disputes about what constitutes racism. Look at the recent media debate about the Bolt case in relation to fair-skinned Aboriginal people. Look at how people shy away from talking about racism. The exception to this is often in sport. Many major sporting bodies understand the benefits of naming a barrier to equality. They understand that to keep recruitment open, to keep spectators safe and players interesting and diverse, they need to create environments that are not only culturally competent, but that tackle racism when it rears its head. Racism takes many forms. In general, it's a belief that a particular race or ethnicity is inferior or superior to others. Racial discrimination involves an act where a person is treated unfairly or vilified because of their race, colour, descent, national or ethnic origin. Racism impacts directly on the full enjoyment of individuals' human rights and, in particular, the right to equality. Racism is experienced across the spectrum. It may occur in a passive way by excluding people socially or being indifferent to their views and experiences. It may take the form of prejudice and stereotyping of different groups in our community, in name-calling, taunting or insults, or in actively and directly excluding or discriminating against people from services on opportunities and opportunities on the basis of their race. For example, in relation to employment opportunities, access to education and participation in sport. It can manifest through commentary or drawings in the media, speeches at public rallies or assemblies and abuse on the internet, including e-forums, blogs and on social networking sites. And in its most serious manifestation, racism is demonstrated in behaviours and activities that embody hate, abuse, violence, particularly experienced by groups who are visibly different as a result of their cultural or religious dress, their skin colour or their physical appearance. On occasions, racism can occur more systemically, as when people with overseas skills and work experience are overlooked for employment, or when job applicants without Anglo-Saxon names have difficulty being offered job interviews. And it is often linked to poverty and lower socioeconomic status, as is the experience of our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples generally. So racism does exist in Australia. We know this is a fact. We know it's a fact because it exists in our complaints to the Australian Human Rights Commission. It's also identified in research. National data from the Challenging Racism Project was released in 2011, and that gave us information about the prevalence of racism and attitudes about racism. We know from this research that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples continue to experience high levels of racism across multiple settings. The research found that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander respondents returned much higher rates of experiences of racism in relation to contact, and this included in relation to contact with police and in seeking housing. And in these particular areas, their experiences of racism were four times that of non-Aboriginal Australians. Similarly, in 2008, other research found that 27% of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples over the age of 15 reported experiencing discrimination in the preceding 12 months, in particular by the general public, in law and justice settings, and in employment. Further recent research has found that three out of four of every Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples regularly experienced race discrimination when accessing primary health care, and that racism and cultural barriers led sub-Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples to not being diagnosed and treated for diseases in their early stages when treatment is most effective. More generally, the challenging racism research resulted in the following findings. Around 85% of respondents believe that racism is a current issue in Australia. Around 20% of respondents have experienced forms of race hate talk. Around 11% of respondents identified as having experienced race-based exclusion from their workplaces and from social activities. 7% of respondents identified as having experienced unfair treatment based on their race, and 6% of respondents reported that they had experienced physical attacks on the basis of their race. This research also found that people born overseas experienced higher rates of racism than those born in Australia and were twice as likely to experience racism in the workplace. Culturally and linguistically diverse communities in Australia are themselves diverse, and each community and generation have quite different experiences of migration and settlement. As a result, their experiences of racism also vary. For example, research suggests that settled immigrants tend to experience lower levels of racism or racist attitudes than their more recent arrivals to Australia. In our own work at the Australian Human Rights Commission, Arab and Muslim Australians and African Australians suggest that these communities are at a higher risk of experiencing discrimination and prejudice. This supports previous research undertaken by the Commission that found that visible ethnic and religious minorities, such as Arabs, Muslims, Africans, Jews, Palestinians, and Turkish people, are groups that are more regularly likely to be subject to racism. And members of these communities themselves identified that their difference in terms of skin colour, dress, and/or cultural practice was the thing that attracted the behaviour to them. There are also particular groups within culturally and linguistically diverse communities which appear to particularly experience racism, and we see this most prevalent way from the so-called shock jock radio presenters who frequently veer into racial stereotyping and demeaning of asylum seekers and refugees. Our own work with international students makes clear that these temporary residents are often taken advantage of or discriminated against by health providers, migration agents, employers and real estate agents because of their race, their colour or their ethnicity, and often also because of their age. Alarmingly, some research indicates a significant increase in racism over recent years. The Scanlon Foundation's Mapping Social Cohesion 2011 report found that in 2010 there was a marked increase in reported racial discrimination, and that this increased reporting was maintained in the 2011 survey. And disturbingly, this research also highlighted the awareness of most Australians about issues faced by our First Nations people was very low and very disengaged. A key feature of racism in Australia is denialism. Such denial may be genuine, may be a genuine lack of understanding that an act may be racist. However, there are deliberate falsehoods, misinformation or evasion. Suggestions of racism may also be dismissed as an overreaction, where people think that telling a racist joke, for example, should be taken as just a bit of fun. Too often, stories start with, "I'm not a racist, but." Ultimately, racism, and I quote, is a denial of human relationship. Yet for many people, it remains almost invisible, unnoticed, except when violence is involved. Those who do not experience it often fail to understand how profoundly offensive it is. The other thing we know about racism is that it's bad for us, and there is significant research that demonstrates the damage that racism causes to individuals and society as a whole. And I'm not going to explore that in detail tonight, but what and the research is actually referenced in the paper for further information. But what this research demonstrates is that racism literally makes you sick. More broadly, racism undermines social cohesion within the community. To ensure social cohesion, individuals need the opportunity to secure a job, access services, connect with family, friends, work, personal interests and local community, deal with personal crises and have their voices heard. Racism towards any individual or community undermines the achievement of these goals. It also impacts adversely on the development of Australia as a multicultural society. If we conceive of multiculturalism as a set of norms or principles which have human rights at their base and which build on the respect, protection and promotion of all of our citizens, then the adverse impacts on groups in the community who may be treated less favourably on the basis of their race is obvious. Multiculturalism supports the ideals of a democratic society in which every person is free and equal in dignity and rights, and racism undermines those very foundations. In this country, the first national anti-discrimination law to be passed addressed racism. Australia became signatory to the International Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination in 1966 and then ratified it in 1975. The ICERD, as it's known as, outlines Australia's obligations to safeguard human rights in the political, economic, social, cultural and other fields of public life so that human rights are ensured to everyone without racial discrimination. The Racial Discrimination Act was then passed in 1975, and that seeks to promote equality before the law for all persons and implements the principles of prohibiting discrimination against people on the basis of their race, colour or national or ethnic origin. The Racial Discrimination Act is also distinctive among Australian anti-discrimination and equality laws in its general provision for equality before the law in Section 10. Unlike most other provisions in the RDA, Section 10 is enforced directly through the courts rather than through complaints to the Commission. And while the number of cases brought under Section 10 has been small, I think it's necessary to name only one of those to understand the importance of that provision, and that case, of course, is Mabo No. 1. Without this case's finding that it was a breach of Section 10 of the Racial Discrimination Act, for the Queensland Government to seek to confirm that it had retrospectively and permanently extinguished any remaining native title over the Torres Strait Islands, Eddie Mabo and his co-plaintiffs would have lost the right to even bring forward the argument that there was such a thing as native title that could be recognised under Australian law. And importantly, the Racial Discrimination Act was amended in 1995 to incorporate specific provisions that relate to actions which are likely to offend, insult, humiliate, or intimidate a person or a group of people. Now, these provisions are also important, although they are contested, in providing additional protections against, for example, race hate. So how do we build social cohesion by addressing racism? We know that racism has an adverse impact on social cohesion, and we know that we have to promote equality as well as addressing racism. At a national level, I think we're at a crossroads in the direction of public policy. We now have a multicultural policy, we have a commitment to developing an anti-racism strategy, we have a social inclusion agenda, we have a sustainable population strategy, And importantly, we have two other processes that are going on. The first is the consolidation of all of the federal anti-discrimination acts into one, well, we hope, a quality act, rather than an anti-discrimination act. And we also have the process of a constitutional referendum on the recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, which has the potential to remove the racist provisions from our own constitution. In relation to the development and implementation of a national anti-racism strategy, this is also an opportunity to raise awareness around racism, and this derives specifically from the People of Australia policy. The government's intention is that a national anti-racism strategy will draw on the expertise of three government departments, the Attorney-General's Department, the Department of Immigration and Citizenship, and the Department of Families, Housing, Community Services and Indigenous Affairs, and working together with the Australian Multicultural Council, the Federation of Ethnic Community Council of Australia, and the National Congress of Australia's First Nations People, it's our task to actually develop this anti-racism strategy. The membership of the partnership makes clear that while the anti-racism strategy was born out of the multicultural policy, we are looking at its development through a much broader filter, encapsulating both the experiences of Australia's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, as well as our culturally and linguistically and religiously diverse communities. We've been tasked with designing, developing and implementing the strategy with five key areas of effort: research and consultation, education resources, public awareness, youth engagement and ongoing evaluation. And as Helen said in the introduction, we hope to have at least the start of the strategy drafted by July 2012 with an implementation over the next few years. Now, last week I released a discussion paper and called for submissions, and we've also run an online survey to try to gauge people's reaction to what will work with a campaign that is addressing racism, and to define and to actually get their ideas about what we should be doing. In addition to that, we're working on the definition of an overarching concept for the strategy. Both the survey and submissions are open to everyone, and I hope you've all got your little business card with the address of the anti-racism website on the back. And I guess what I would say tonight is that it is a call to action, because we need to be able to demonstrate through evidence, through interest, through your responses to the submission, and more importantly to the online survey, that there is an interest and concern about racism and that we should be doing something about it. And ultimately, many of the suggestions that are already coming up in the consultations are suggesting more resources. So at least this is the basis to going back to government, although hope of getting money out of the government's pretty low, I think, at the moment. So what I want to demonstrate through this process is, if we resolve from talking about racism, we'll actually get the country behind this initiative, and then we need to build the case, so what we need really is volume as well as content in the consultation phase. So we really are encouraging you, if you've got good ideas, we'd love to hear from them. What I should say is that an anti-racism strategy is not going to fix the problem per se, but what it will do is it will help us to shine some light on the issues that we're often too shy to confront in the normal circumstances, or to shine the light on the sort of issues that we often deny exist, the circumstances that exist where people experience racism. And what we hope from this is that it will make Australia stronger, not weaker, in promoting our diversity. There's a wonderful quote from Archbishop Desmond Tutu, which says, "Differences are not intended to separate, to alienate. We are all different precisely in order to realise our need for one another." And often what we find is we withdraw from difference rather than embracing it. We're threatened by difference, and so this often leads to people being treated differently by virtue of their race, even when we actively recruit them to come to this country, even when they were here long before us. However, if we commit to developing sound policies and programs that address the structural barriers to inclusion, if we work in partnership with communities and NGOs, business and academics, and build on our diverse strengths, I believe that we can create innovative solutions to some of the problems that I've outlined. Our benchmark for success, of course, should not be that we are better than the worst human rights offenders. As a prosperous and thriving multicultural society, we should aim to be the world's leaders in putting human rights principles into practice. And I want to conclude by giving you the opportunity to walk in someone else's shoes. One of the participants in our consultations with the African communities told us the following story, and I quote, "I got on the bus and there was one seat left next to a woman at the back. But as I was walking up, I noticed that she put her bag on the empty seat. I thought, not again. But I decided I would this time do something different. So I walked up to the seat and I looked at the bag and I said to the bag, 'Did you pay?' And then I said, 'What? You didn't pay?' The woman quickly snatched her bag, and as I went to sit on the seat, she turned her back to me. So I did the same, and then the people on the bus started clapping, and I felt very good to know that not all people in Australia are like that. When people look back at us 50 years from now, what will they think? Will we be seen as people complicit in allowing racism and inequality in its various guises to exist and continue? Will we wonder about social cohesion and the impact of race and wonder if we should have done more? Or will we be the people who learned from the experiences of the past, harness the possibilities of the present, and work to create a different future? And I guess that's the challenge that I'm putting out for all of us to rise to meet today. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Helen. So we're going to move straight on to Milsom's response. And Milsom's got a PowerPoint presentation for those of you who are wanting to take notes. Milsom.
Thank you. Good evening. I too would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land, the Wurundjeri people of Kulin Nations, and to pay my respect to elders past and present. Thanks to Helen for her informative speech, and I particularly welcome the appointment of a full-time race commissioner and the broad and collaborative scope of the new national anti-racism strategy, which includes the Indigenous bodies. These are steps, I believe, in the right direction. But first, let me start with my own background, just to give you a little bit of indication of where I'm coming from. I arrived in Australia over 10 years ago, as you can see, as a visibly different skilled migrant who has, though, by virtue of my British background, been able to fit into an Australian society because of the social and political privilege of being British. These varying identities have provided me with a very distinctive viewpoint to look at Australia from the outside and from within. And I must confess to being somewhat alarmed by some of the peculiarities of the Australian psyche, especially over the last few years. And more recently, I wrote about this in an online opinion piece, which was talking about, well, the title was "Why Australians Whinging? It's time you take a good hard look in the mirror, Australia." And one of the bits of the article that I focus on, I want to draw attention to today, is why racism is such a problematic issue in Australia. In the piece, I just asked a few questions and the following. I'll read some of them out. Why is there still a reluctance, I was asking, to acknowledge the historical legacy of race and its dissemination of the first Australians? How could a gap between Indigenous and other Australians be overlooked for so long? How could any meaningful discussion about multiculturalism seriously be attempted or fully realised without understanding the past relationship between first Australians and the first settlers? Why does it appear to be un-Australian to even to call Australian society racist? How can such a narrow and at times inhumane view of asylum seekers, refugees, and some migrants be allowed to dominate and constrict any effective discussion and action? Why aren't we even championing our place within the Asia-Pacific regions? It seems incredible, I ask, that these issues are not being seriously tackled, as Australia is in fact in an enviable position to take advantage of real engagement with its Indigenous communities, to extend its multicultural credentials, and to harness the potential of its regional position within the Asia-Pacific. So those are some of the questions that I kind of start off when I think about racism in Australia. But also professionally as a sociologist, my teaching and research interests focus on critically exploring difference and diversity. And for that, I'm just going to just briefly outline to you some of the definitions of racism, which I think Helen has hinted at as well. But I also wanted to point out that, unfortunately, the notion of race isn't behind us. Race, and indeed racism, still matters, so it is still highly relevant even in the 21st century. So defining racism, I'm not going to go into, this is really just about giving you some background for the slides, but racism itself within an academic sense is still a problematic term, because it stems from a belief that there are biologically different people on the basis of race, yet we know that there are greater genetic differences between siblings and genders than there are between different races. As a social scientist then, race is seen as being socially constructed, defined by those in power to name, to exclude individuals or groups in both a real and symbolic sense. And racist discrimination are really then practices and behaviours that result in unfair and unavoidable inequalities between groups in society based on race, religion, culture, or ethnicity. And it involves explicit and covert forms of interpersonal and systemic forms of discrimination. And that's a quote from the Vic Health programme. And we also know that what's happened to the notion of race has shifted over time, so that it shifted from being fairly overt acts of racism to more subtle forms of racism, to institutional and new forms of racism, where cultural difference is asserted in terms such as, I am not racist, but, which are often followed by a highly racist comment. So we should not be deluded then that from thinking that racism today still doesn't have a major role in society. As I think Helen hinted at, just to briefly give you the other context of my role here at Melbourne, is a project talking about how visible migrants and refugees resettle in rural and regional parts of Australia. We look specifically at notions of visibility, identity, and community. We've interviewed nearly 400 participants, mostly kind of key settlement stakeholders, visible migrants and refugees across 8 regional and metropolitan areas of Victoria. The further details are there. But the notion of visibility is one area that we're looking at, which I think is highly relevant to tonight's discussion about racism, equality, and social cohesion here in Australia. So when we talk about visibility in the project, we acknowledge that the recent arrivals to Australia of both migrants and refugees from Africa, Asia, and the Middle East, particularly over the last 10 to 15 years, presents a new sort of stage, if you like, in settlement in Australia. So we are keen to acknowledge and explore the diversity of experiences of visible migrants and refugees, particularly those who settle in rural and regional locations. And we argue that the concept of visibility allows for a more critical and a new focus on the process of settlement. It is our hypothesis, then, that visibility matters and is a potentially useful concept to explore the experiences of these particular set of newly arrived peoples. And what we mean by that is it's not simply about race or ethnic origin. It's about naming and acknowledging difference. It has a multidimensional feature, and it has differential impacts on settlement between metropolitan and rural and regional locations. And we also know that visibility, the notion of visibility and indeed invisibility, can be seen as both positive and negative. So it's a useful way to explore that process. We also know that for many recent arrivals in Australia, as Helen indicated as well, visibility is both a real and symbolic feature of everyday life, and it does have a major impact on the overall sense of self. So our research to date then supports some of the existing research that Helen already outlined from the Australian Human Rights Commission, from the Challenging Racism Research, and from the more local Vic Health Localities Embracing and Accepting Diversity, the LEAD project here, all of which point out that racism is real. Further, we support the view that the experiences of racism vary considerably and have also varied over time. That racism is indeed complex and often difficult to unravel about where it begins and where it ends. But its ability to define, to control, and maintain differences and inequalities is profound. So race matters because even though it is biologically disputed, its social impact is immense. It affects our life chances, influences our health, wealth, status, and power. And racism clearly damages not just the individuals, but societies, because it does prevent social inclusion and threaten social cohesion. But how do we talk about racism in Australia? Do we, in fact, talk about racism in Australia? I don't think we do it enough, or we certainly don't do it with enough movement towards action. And one of the key issues is that we cannot fully talk about it because there's a real climate of denial, and Helen has hinted that already. And this is curtailed by notions in some way that it's actually un-Australian to even call Australian racist. But if we look at one of our two recent prime ministers, their understandings of racism, we can see that it's obviously in quite good company. John Howard said back in 2005, "I do not accept that there is underlying racism in society." And even Kevin Rudd in 2010 said that, "I do not believe that racism is at work in Australia." These are quite damning indictments on the level of racism. And as new migrants arrive in here, and indeed Indigenous peoples, that is quite a shocking statement. So the fact that our two most recent prime ministers dispute the presence of racism reflects Australia's inability to understand both the pernicious and the cumulative effects of racism on individuals, groups, communities, and society. It also illustrates the extent of the denial about racism and the lack of concrete and sustained action by our political leaders. This, I argue, stems from a failure, as I think Helen has hinted as well, to acknowledge the first Australians, to ignore the multicultural roots that existed at the time of Federation, through to the development of the White Australia Policy, and which, despite the dismantling of that policy only 40 years ago, it still has remnants in existing multicultural policies. The fact that until fairly recently, existing equality laws around racism were suspended when applied to the Northern Territory intervention, or that current political and public discourses about migrants and refugees are still coded as non-white others who do not fully belong, or indeed that there remain key barriers to social cohesion and inclusion for this group, is a damning indictment for the 21st century Australia. So I argue that we need to critically deconstruct this pernicious, pervading, and often all too determinative view or discourse of racism. This is a role, though, not only for governments — they can't do all this all by themselves — but it is a role for individuals, communities, and organisations. And we need to learn to adopt a zero tolerance of racism in all its forms, as well as celebrating and promoting difference as beyond the negative discourse of otherness. A failure to do this will lead to a waste of all our potentials. But we can't talk about racism in Australia without talking about the link to multiculturalism in a bit more detail, and indeed the link to immigration and debates about population. Multiculturalism at the level of policy has, in the last couple of years under the current federal government, attempted to move from being a dirty word, and we recognise that and welcome that. It's attempted to move away from being a political football, a neglected policy, to one that offers tolerance of difference in exchange for rights and responsibilities, and more critically, seen as a reality that shapes all Australians, not just those who are non-white. So on one level, that is a good step. But as a policy, it is still, as I said before, rooted in a discourse of otherness which values highly whiteness, and as a result focuses too much on a narrow conception of equality and meaningful exchange. So as soon as we talk, for example, about the terms migrant, ethnic, and race, this is seen as the domain of the non-white population. And this emphasis makes true and sustainable equality almost impossible to achieve. So what I'm arguing for is that we need to find and redevelop a viable, sustainable multicultural policy and practice which should be about being open to diversity in all its forms, to help us to eradicate the culture of racism in all its insidious formats, to challenge individuals to think and act beyond immediate prejudices, as well as providing the legislative teeth to ensure that governments and organisations and others develop and enact an anti-racism agenda. An active and engaging anti-human rights discourse can serve as a really good foundation for critically reviewing multiculturalism, immigration, and notion of populations, particularly where notions of equality and social cohesion can be realised. So what I'm looking for, is a holistic approach which does involve all of us. And I think the former Commissioner Graham Innes sort of stated that we are all responsible for naming and saying no to racism. We must call it when we see it. Race hate, racism, careless words can harm entire populations. They can change the way that we live together. Racism, then, can only be resisted and eradicated through solidarity and cooperation. There are no exceptions. History has no bystanders, only participants. So this does mean that we need to find ways to unlearn racism. So I am pleased that there is a beginnings of a strategy at the national federal level, which will, as Helen pointed out, focus on those five areas. And this represents an important shift within the Australian political and policy landscape, and I hope we all support it. I also hope that it will be well-resourced so that it can be proactive and flexible in its scope and its recommendations, and it can take into account the emerging research which argues for a holistic and sustained approach to dismantling racism in all its forms. So we really need to focus on what this anti-racist approach is, and I'm just going to briefly highlight in the next two slides what an anti-racist framework would look like. And just drawing on the Challenging Racism research in 2011, which offers an interesting array of ideas for policy and practice. And as most of us in this audience imagine are either academics or policy workers or activists, some of these ideas I think will all make sense. But it's all about dispelling false beliefs, encouraging people and encouraging them to feel empathy for others so they can identify with them, encouraging individuals to have contact with members of cultural groups for which they have disdain, for interrogating the notion of white privilege and using as a strategy to increase people's awareness of the colorblind privilege that particularly comes with being Anglo-Australian. That to ask citizens to take responsibility for what happens in public spaces and helping them find ways to do so, to address racism structurally and institutionally, and to use the new kind of social marketing and media tools to counteract existing forms of discrimination. And also the LEAD project, which I hinted at before, has offered us a number of perspectives which are linked into this anti-racist framework, which is about addressing disadvantage, about strengthening minority ethnic communities and Indigenous identity, building positive attitudes and behaviours, building inclusive communities, building inclusive community identities. All these indicate that the policy that we develop needs to have firm teeth, as well as being relevant, proactive, and flexible. So, in summary, my understanding of racism in Australia as an outsider and an insider is that it's about the past, current, and future failure to understand, to develop, and engage with the concept of difference as beyond the discourses of negative otherness. So what I'd like us to do in the questions that will come up is to think about all the possibilities opened up by a notion of difference that is not defined or operated or maintained or reinforced in that negative context of otherness, inferiority, or competition for resources. Let us take the time tonight to imagine what type of individual, group, organisation, community, society, or indeed world could be created outside of those notions. Such a vision would radically change who we are and what we are politically, economically, socially, individually, and collectively. It should be possible, then, for us to conceive of Australia as being truly equal, socially cohesive, polyethnic, where photos of Australian flag, hijab-wearing women are not seen as extraordinary, to a position where it is in the potential of all of us that matters to really be that lucky country. And in order to get to that utopian point, let's do more than talk about racism. Let's find the spaces to widen the conversation, to act individually and collectively now. We don't need to wait for any more proof that racism exists. That definitely would be un-Australian. Thanks for listening.
Thanks very much, Milsom. So I'm now going to invite Helen and Milsom to come and sit at the front, and we will open the discussion for questions. I'm not going to say any more. I think that was a very rich presentation, so I want to go to the audience and get some questions and comments. So who would like to go first? Yes, gentleman here. Can you wait till the microphone gets to you, please?
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed your presentation. I'm an Indigenous Australian. Due to the policy, the White Australia policy that existed when I was adopted, I have no knowledge of my racial origin or family background. I hear a lot of academic assessment talking about the subtlety and embedded nature of racism, but I think there's a broader context. I think it begins with policy and the lack of denial and the denial that is taking place historically in the genocide that occurred to the First People. And I think on a global level, this is currently being reinforced by foreign policy that is discriminating against Muslim people in Central Asia. So we have a continuation of this cycle in a global context. Our foreign policy supports this policy. It seems like a repetition of the policy of invasion. So I don't think racism is as subtle as we would like to believe. I think we also have apartheid policy that's occurring in Australia, with which you spoke about, with the Stronger Futures policy. And I just wonder, until we historically acknowledge the genocide, the systemic eugenics, this is not a subtle act. This is a very intentional act of wiping out an entire race. And also the current policies that endorse that. And I think there's a broader context which is to do with economics, which is about the control of resources. So whilst we might address these issues internally and holistically on a community level, I think we need to address this in a broader spectrum. And I think we need to rewrite history from an Aboriginal perspective and bring that context into this conversation, if I may say, because I think it's very easy to talk about subtleties and cultural subtleties, but these are overt, aggressive actions that we haven't really acknowledged. So we've got lack of constitutional recognition, the genocide, the stolen generation, the lack, the economic disparity that is caused by the displacement of the traditional people, so we can exploit resources. These are global issues that are occurring on this land. I'm just wondering how you would respond to that.
Do you want both to respond?
Yes. Oh, well, thanks very much for the comment. And I guess my response, if I just look at the domestic situation, I get the things that concern me are, first of all, the lack of awareness by the majority of Australians of A, the history, and B, the importance of the history. And that's why I think the issues around the education campaign, which is what it's now being called, that the federal government have given money to Reconciliation Australia to run an education campaign that might precede a consultation or around whether or not we should have a referendum, whether we should go to referendum around constitutional recognition, is probably important. And in my presentation, I actually gave the example of the at level of awareness within the social cohesion data, which is now trending over 4 years, of issues faced by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders in Australia, and that recognition is very, very low. So in terms of what we do domestically, I think we've got a major challenge. And and part of what has to come out of the constitutional reform process is to encourage Australians to understand that we are diminished as a country if, in fact, we don't understand the history and what and the damage and dispossession that's been done, and if we don't rectify that by this constitutional challenge. But it's a very big step to go. And I'll just use part of the process of the Mick Gooder, who's my colleague, who's the Social Justice Commissioner, was an ex officio member of the expert panel. You may know Mick. I think everyone knows Mick. And you may have heard this story, but other people may not have. As part of the process, one of the biggest areas to crack generally in terms of racism is the media and the portrayal of people through the media in a general sense. And so he was given the job of going off to talk to the shock jocks. And he tells the story of how he met with Alan Jones, because the Sydney boys are worse than our boys here. And he made the point that his younger sister had said to him, you know, you and I are different, Mick, because I was born in 1967 after the referendum. So by the time I was born, I was actually recognised as a person. I was counted in the census and I could vote. And Alan Jones said, you know, yeah, but what are you trying to say? And he said, well, Mick said, I was born in 1955, so I was a non-person. So even within families there are those differences. And by humanising that story, there was a kind of dint in the armour of, you know, cynicism around what the constitutional recognition process might mean as it's rolled out. So I think part of what we have to do is get that story out to broader Australians so that they can... I mean, it is that kind of notion of walking in other people's shoes, because I don't think people understand the depth of the damage that's been done in that regard.
I take your point exactly. I mean, before I arrived in Australia, I had limited understanding of Indigenous peoples in Australia. And particularly when I arrived, I was really shocked to see how displaced and how they weren't around in sort of the urban centres, and that there were only certain parts of Australia where they were. I think there are two issues. I think there's the importance of understanding that history and seeing it, as you say, in that very overt sense. I think it's very true. And but I'm actually really pleased to see that there is some discussion and there's some collaboration with the issue of racism as we see it today in society as well. So I think it's really important that the Indigenous experience is seen as part of this kind of national dialogue and debate without diminishing what has happened to Indigenous peoples as well. So I think there is room for collaboration, but we need to remember they're very distinctive and different set of experiences as well. So thank you. Yeah.
Would you like to say anything in response?
Is Indigenous history and the recognition a major component of the policies that you're working on developing? Or your consultation process?
Well, we're working with the National Congress, but the other thing, of course, as you know, is that for Australian and Torres Strait Islanders, they are consulted exhaustively with often very little return. So we're trying to ensure that through the Congress in particular that we have that voice represented there. I guess the other thing I would say is that in a sense... you commented about you hope this is a well-resourced strategy. Well, it's not. And basically what we will be doing, I guess, is, you know, trying to rally a call to action around, you know, highlighting racism and putting it on the agenda. And that's quite tricky. So, for example, one of the departments who sits on the Partnership Forum is, of course, the same department that is rolling out the Stronger Futures initiatives in the Northern Territory. And what we know about the experience of our First Nations people is that that's where the most embedded and systemic forms of racism exist. But anyway, it's very much front and centre, but it's going to be a challenge, and there's going to have to be other things that happen as well that actually start to make a difference.
Okay, who's next? I've got one just behind, and then there's one over here. We'll go to now.
Hi. My question is about the breadth of policies and influence across different policies. I can't not agree that racism is a factor in exploitation of individuals and groups of people. But I wonder to what extent some of that can be tackled by looking really quite broadly at things like industrial relations reform. The example you gave about in Western Australia, that sounds very much like I don't know the details, but, you know, ensuring adequate pay, good workplace conditions and so on, so where individuals or groups of people might be exploited based on their naivety and the fact that their race might play into it because they're groups of recent arrivals and they are naive because of their arrival status makes them more vulnerable.
Well, I think the other bit of the equation is that there's a huge power differential in a lot of those examples as well. So... In terms of the National Anti-Racism Strategy, That is, it's a part of a jigsaw of many other things that are happening. And I mentioned briefly the issue of what's happening at a federal level in terms of the anti-discrimination laws, and whether in fact we end up with consolidated anti-discrimination laws, which are a better kind of instrument, I guess, for providing protections on the basis of discrimination than what we might have as individual laws that are separate. So that's how it operates at the federal level at the moment. And I think one of the key challenges, and to some extent Victoria has done better in this regard, is whether we actually have laws that deal with matters after the fact, or where we have laws that require governments in particular, but also other people who have responsibilities under the law, to be proactive about some of those issues. And I'm not sure that we're going to get that. So let me just give you a couple of examples. I've already given you the example of FACSIA being a strange beast, which on the one hand is rolling out legislation that where we feel that the human rights considerations haven't been fully taken into account, but on the other hand sits on this partnership forum. Well, at a federal government level, I think there's a lot of work that has to be done where government departments, and particularly those government departments that interface with the community in one way or another, and through Centrelink or Medibank, or by the provision of policies which relate to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, actually do their own kind of filtering of what are their obligations in relation to racism, and part of that is about how are they proactive, and how do they scrutinise their own laws to make sure that discrimination doesn't come into effect, or there aren't unintended consequences as a result of their laws. So, I think it's part of a jigsaw. And there are many other mechanisms that have to be brought in play that provide those protections. An anti-racism strategy isn't going to do that. An anti-racism strategy at its best can, as I say, shine a light on those issues and get people to identify them and talk about them. But it needs to be backed up by other things. And laws are one of those, policies and procedures and actions of government are another.
So we'll go just here at the front, Joe. Yeah. Oh, sorry, I'm going to make you walk all the way around. But we'll stay over that side for a bit then. So just here.
Hi. I think this is a really important conversation. I would like to say that I'm amazed that nobody has mentioned terra nullius. I think that continues to be part of the psyche of what it means to be Australian. I think also that we haven't really encompassed the enormous importance to Australia of the White Australia policy. My great-grandfather's Edmund Barton, so he's one of the people who put together. So, when you consider what was going on for Australia at that point, I think, we have a completely kind of skewed perspective of what it meant to this new nation to have this be a white nation. Really, really central. I agree that this is all about resources, and terra nullius was about resources, and that we continue to be a privileged white nation, and we've got to choose all of our history, who we want and who we don't want. And that continues to play out the whole time. And the other thing is, race is socially constructed, but so is whiteness. So I think one of the things that continues to be missing from this conversation is what it means to be socially enculturated to be white. And there's nothing wrong with white skin, but I know what it means to be a privileged white Australian is it means to learn to be selfish and greedy and opportunistic and, a whole lot of things that are about keeping resources. So whenever we do anything like this, there will be a violent backlash. Anyone who looks at Mabo will know what happened. Certainty was required, so we got the Native Title Act that we got. So I think that, there needs to be a kind of recognition of the psychic damage that has to be done to white people to, you know, have us act like this, because, you know, I think we're not born racist.
Yeah, and that's absolutely spot on. I think there isn't enough done about it. There are some more recent emergence of studies talking about whiteness and interrogating whiteness, but also understanding the heterogeneity of it as well, that not all white people are the same. And yes, and I think that there is it's very easy to fall in the judgment, say that all white people are racist. That's clearly not what most people are saying. Most people are saying it is just it's the power and the privilege invested in whiteness that gives that privilege, and that needs to be disrupted. Yeah, absolutely.
Who's next? Okay, so we'll go at the back. There's a gentleman at the back, Joe, who's on the end in the blue shirt.
Hi, I'm Gary Woodard, and I'm a colleague of Milsom's and Helen's. I was High Commissioner in Malaysia in the early 1980s when Dr. Mahathir Mohamad came to power, and he had an animus against Australia because of some experience he'd had in the past. There were many theories as to what that particular experience was. However, he said to me that, not with a very good grace, he said to me, none of my colleagues, and these were Chinese, Indian and Malay, who went to an Australian university has other than a good word to say about Australia. Now, the problems with universities today are on a vaster scale, but I think we should bring the question back to home a little and ask to what extent our overall policy takes account of the situation in each university in Australia and what we're learning from experiences in each of our universities.
Trouble hearing the first bit of that question, sorry.
But basically I think your question was, you know, what should we be doing in our universities in terms of the experience of people coming here from other countries or learning experiences? Oh, I see. Yeah. Well, I'm not from a university, so I'm probably the one that's going to speak most authoritatively because I don't have any responsibility. And I guess what I would say is that from the work that we've had a glimpse of this, I guess, in relation to the experiences of international students and the problems that arose in the context of in Melbourne and in Victoria in particular, but also in other campuses across the country. And that's, you know, the consequences of that have been quite dramatic, probably coupled with a few other things like the strength of the Australian dollar in terms of, you know, revenue streams for universities. So I'm not sure that what we've learned out of that in a specific sense, but there's a lot of room to actually think about. You would think that, I guess, an institution which is on about learning is an institution that should be best adept to actually understand things like cultural competency and inclusiveness and, you know, the benefits of diversity and the kind of innovation that comes out of that. But from the glimpse that I've seen from the international student sector, that's not necessarily the case. But beyond that, I'm not sure I can comment. I would say that we are still doing some work on the development of minimum standards for international students, which are based on human rights considerations. We still think there's scope to do that internationally. There's a global compact that I think is being developed in that space. Maybe that will help universities reflect on their own experiences. I don't know.
I mean, I would add to that by saying that I think the picture is mixed. I think there's a difference between how students from overseas experience the teaching, the learning aspect of being at university to actually being living in Australia. I think there are two different contexts for that. So, and I think that when students, particularly in my courses within the arts and the social sciences, certainly students who come from overseas have, I think, a greater sense of engagement with the notion of difference and cultural diversity, and they want to see that reflected in their teaching and their learning. And I think over the years that has become much more accessible and available to them, where as in the past, that was less likely to be the case. There's still, I think, students from overseas who, if you look at the student body, particularly at Melbourne University, compare that to the actual staff members in terms of difference and diversity, it's still not reflected. There's a long way to go in terms of that. But I would go back to sort of backing what Helen was saying about the lived experience of students who live within Melbourne or Sydney or other parts of Australia, that they do experience more instances of racism if they're visibly different as well. So I think there's a mixed picture that's going on.
Okay. If you can go back up the back, Joe. There's a couple of people who have had their hands up for a while. Lady in the blue T-shirt, I think.
I'm just interested in finding out, is there anything in the strategy or in the research that looks at bringing back people that have been treated as an other for a long time to the notion of being Australian? For example, a lot of Africans, even second generation that have been born here, identify as African Australian because they've been treated as an other for a very long time and can never get to that notion of being Australian, or the impact that tags have on identifying with a national identity. If you've been a refugee for more than 15 years or 10 years, how do you then come to the definition of Australian? And yet the definition of being Australian excludes everybody else.
That's a very valid point, and that's certainly there within the literature and the research about how, you know, at what point do you stop becoming a migrant or a refugee? At what point can you say that you belong? And if you're visible, how can you belong when you stand out? They're all sort of pertinent questions. It does challenge what it means to be Australian, and it should keep on challenging what it means to be Australian, because everyone earns the right who wants to live here, who gets permanent residence here, to claim what it is to be an Australian identity. It shouldn't be the claim of just one group of people. And we should all fight for that right to say that it's more than just being a citizen in terms of rights and obligations, that we belong here and we have a part to play here as well. So I think that's a really kind of key message that needs to come through. One of the things that we found in our research was that when people said that they really want to belong, particularly people who've just arrived or been here for like 5 years, they said that as much as they wanted to belong, they felt there was a difference between being Australian. And when they talked about it being Australian, it was about being white Australian. And they also talked about it being about ochre Australian. So particularly when things like Aussie, 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 or the flags come out or whatever, there's a great sense of unease. There's a very similar thing that happened in the UK about being black and British. And over time, that got better. But it's about those communities and us all kind of reclaiming it, saying that, you know, white Australians can't just own that flag. They can't just own that identity. It has to be much more open and broad than that. So, yeah.
It's also a question of what people, how we project ourselves through media in a general sense. And I'm reminded of the story when there was a big international conference in Melbourne last year, which was looking at the arts, and there was a fantastic woman who came out from the British Council who was black. And I said to her, "How have you found Melbourne?" And she said, "Oh, you know, I'm really amazed. My sister rang me from England. And she said, what's Melbourne like? And I said to my sister, you're not going to believe it, but there are black people here. And their whole image of Australia was from Neighbours. I mean, she was much more cultured than just Neighbours, but she said, you know, that's the kind of predominant paradigm of how Australia reflects itself. And then you see the incredible hoo-ha when Neighbours casts an Indian family. And the producers actually said to us, we just are not even going to go near a Muslim family because there's no way that the audience is ready for that. So, you know, when you just think about that as one indicator of what how we represent ourselves, and that's very different from the UK, who don't do other things so well. So I think we've got a long way to go.
Okay, and the gentleman behind, please.
Hi, just a couple of comments. The first one's to Mr. Goddard's question about addressing international students' experiences in unis. And there's a very good book by Simon Marginson. It's from the Department of Education. And he was saying, like, just the idea is international students come here and learning is only one way so they come here and we international students only learn from an Anglo culture and they haven't got much to offer in the, and so that's perhaps one way it can be addressed. And the book was Ideas for Intercultural Education. And yeah, the second comment was, last night I was just reading on the SBS website about a particular topic, and the topic was, is multiculturalism in Australia working? And there's lots of comments, and I was expecting at least some sort of balance, viewpoints in the comments, but I was quite surprised, like 60 to 70% of the comments were actually quite negative, and they were saying like no, multiculturalism isn't working, and this is going to be quite offensive to most people on some level, I think, but basically most of the comments were saying things like white Australia is under attack and allowing multiculturalism to exist will destroy white Australia, which built Australia up, which is comes back to what people have been saying about the resources thing and protecting that resources. So that's just my comments. And so it's good to, for earlier someone mentioned about this psyche being damaged and because we weren't born racist, so it's good to hear that. Thanks.
I'd just comment, we do know about Simon Margeson, and he's done some fantastic work in that particular area. But just generally, I think one of the challenges that we have in developing an anti-racism strategy is how we get to people beyond the sort of people who, I guess, are in this room, who are true believers, and what can we do? You know, how can you change attitudes? And I mean, part of the way you change attitudes is by you know, putting, I guess, the vignettes that make people walk in other people's shoes or relating it to their own experience. So, for example, we've had some very preliminary discussions with the RSL because a lot of people across Australia congregate in RSL clubs and they've done a lot of work to actually try to build bridges across, you know, the wars and across communities that were involved in the war and so on. And they're the sort of things that I guess we need to think about a little bit because, the research shows that, I mean, there's a hard core of people who are deliberately, overtly, consciously racist, but there's a kind of bigger group of people who actually don't necessarily acknowledge what is a racist act because they're part of the white majority and because they don't see it as hurtful or damaging. And it's probably that group is the group that we've got to somehow get them to focus a bit better on the negative impacts of what's going on.
There's a gentleman here. Please, Joe.
Thanks. I won't comment much on the Aboriginal situation, so I don't know anything about it, except that one of my daughters is married to a part Aborigine, and I have three part Aborigine grandchildren who haven't experienced any racial problems at school or anything like this. But I do have some experience of multiculturalism, first of all in South Africa, which is probably the most multicultural country in the world, but more particularly in Canada. Now, Canada adopted a multicultural immigration program many years ago because the English-speaking Canadians wanted to lessen the influence of French-speaking Canada. So they started bringing a lot of only English-speaking Commonwealth people in, and they say to these people, you don't have to become Canadian, you can stay West Indian, you can stay Indian, you can stay this sort of thing. And this has led to more problems. They've had race riots between blacks and whites in Toronto and so forth, this sort of thing. So I must say I don't favour multiculturalism if that's what it leads to. I'm not suggesting we go to the black, white-only immigration policy, but people should be explained that we want them to become Australians. and not stay the way they were. See what I'm getting at?
Thanks for the comment, and thanks for making it in a, you know, in a room of people who have probably a different view to yours. I guess the thing that I always say, though, when I hear that, is that part of what is little understood, and this is superficial, but it goes to the point about our First Nations people as well, that the best way to actually facilitate people to become part of a community is also to support them in remaining connected to the two cultures and tradition and language that they may bring over here. And in a sense, to allow them to come from a position of strength to be part of this community. That's the first thing. And the second thing is to recognise that there are often either invisible or definite barriers that are often institutionalised that prevent them to become Australians, I guess, to use your phraseology. And the point of this discussion about multiculturalism or about racism or about, you know, any of those things, I guess, is to keep an eye on what those things are to facilitate that. And you know, it astonishes me that we've been comfortable enough to take, you know, the kind of the colour, light, movement and tastes of different nationalities, but not actually to embrace, you know, people in such a ready way. And you know, we're a small country, we're an island. You know, multiculturalism is a reality of one sort or another, whether it's with our First Nations people or subsequently. And I think that the thing would be really, well, how do we continue to improve on what's happening rather than deny it or reject it, would be my comment.
My comment would be that, I mean, I come from a viewpoint that sees, I would question what it is to be Australian, and I would question that in the sense that being Australian is not fixed in time, that it changes. Culture by its very nature is about dynamic change. It's about growing, it's about learning. It's a good multiculturalism policy for me is one that actually engages that, that brings that to the fore. I think it also comes from a viewpoint that that we've got nothing to lose. That what is there to lose about encompassing and encouraging people from different parts of the world to live in this large, vast continent called Australia? We have nothing to lose. If we are assured about who we are as a country, and I think we can do that with lots of different groups of people, then bring it on, Australia. This is, you can do it.
Okay. I've got one down here, and then we'll go back up there.
Thanks very much. Very interesting conversation. I'm from perhaps a slightly different background to a lot of people in the room. I work in a large corporation, so I've sort of grown up in that world. I think that corporations are perhaps some of the last to move with the times on these issues, and it's not a conversation that takes place in the boardrooms. I'd be interested in your views because cynically, I think unless the shareholders or the government pressures a corporation who control a lot of the resources, there is very little impetus on those organisations to take steps towards mitigating some of these problems. And I'd be interested in your views on how we could address that problem and improve the situation.
It's interesting. I won't name the organisation, but we held an event recently to actually bring a range of the bigger companies together to talk about this issue, and the name of the forum was, you know, something about the National Anti-Racism Strategy, and the predictable host organisation came back and said, no, we don't want to be associated with that, that's far too negative. And we in fact have had that roundtable discussion, and it's quite interesting about how we might proceed. One of the challenges is that there is a great deal of complexity in measurement and actually knowing how well organisations are doing. And this is a challenge for government as well. So whilst you might be able to have clear indicators about gender or about age, It's much harder to have genders around cultural diversity. It's a little bit easier maybe for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, but you know, even then, probably through the Reconciliation Action Plan process, there's been built a much more more productive environment where people can identify as being Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander. So I think one of the challenges for corporations is about, you know, how do we know how they're doing other than just doing a quick scan of the top boardrooms of the country, which are probably looking reasonably pale in one way or another. But it's also about how do we measure the progression. So for a lot of the major corporations, they would have a graduate intake that would be very diverse, and not much of that is kind of filtering through. So we've started that discussion, and I think that there is some important groundwork that's been done with many of those organisations, which will actually lead to some of them being more ready to step up to the mark. And in a sense, as we know with all of these things, we need a few trailblazers, and that starts the momentum around how to address these issues. But I think just to take this gentleman's point, that the other challenge is that we are going into a period which is a very different economic period. So we've seen some of the major corporations, reducing staff significantly. So the issue of, how do you build inclusiveness? How do you generate this kind of environment in workplaces that are downsizing, where people won't want to see that there's a particular group that's getting special treatment? That's going to be a real challenge into the future.
I agree. I think, though, that there's a lot of work that needs to be done about understanding what institutional racism is, and that needs to be taken up not just to those big corporations but to governments as well. They've been pretty slack about looking at their own kind of staffing issues. And I think that the policies about access and equity need to have more teeth. I think we know that, particularly when you talk about employment, how hard it is for people who are visibly different, even in terms of names, to get traction or to get employment or to get promotion in particular organisations. And it's at that point where someone's making a decision which is kind of behind the scenes. As an applicant, you don't know what's going on. But it's about changing that cultural thing, about saying that ultimately, if you want the best person for the job, then let's think about different ways of doing that. Let's think about, I think Helen was talking about neighbours being an export category to the UK. Just an understanding from people in the media and people in governments and organisations that by having somebody who is culturally diverse doesn't detract away from your economic modelling. It actually can enhance it. There are possibilities. There are more possibilities than there are negatives. And let's get with it. So, yeah.
Okay. You still? Yep. Yeah, there's a lady there in a white top, about halfway up, Joe.
Thank you very much for leading this very important conversation.
Could you just put the microphone a bit closer?
Sure. Thank you very much for leading this very important conversation. I'm just noting recently in this same room, the Victorian Auditor General was here, and he was asked a question, which was, when will he start to audit government's accountability against government policies which deal with taking up the responsibilities that go with human rights? So we're talking a lot about the issue of racism. The flip side of that coin is actually taking up the responsibilities that go with building social cohesion. So I'm actually looking at the... Pardon?
What did he say?
Thank you for raising that issue. He was very respectful and he was listening, so I'll watch that space. The other, following on that, that is one accountability measure of how government money is actually spent in order to attract funding for the sorts of initiatives which will assist. The other things are Victoria Police looking at social disengagement and the cost to the Victorian community in policing and safety due to social disengagement. VicHealth, the studies that you've pointed to, have looked at the enormous cost to the health budget that come actually from disengaged societies and the health impacts that come ultimately from racism and not building social cohesion. The education department is seeing similar issues. Housing is seeing similar issues. The Justice Department is seeing similar issues. All these departments do have budgets. Perhaps the key point is for these departments to actually start realizing that tackling these issues is not just Helen's issue alone, or not just the NGO's issues alone, or the charitable organizations, but that a budget of all of these departments is actually already being used to look at the negative effects of racism that could so easily be turned towards contributing towards positive social engagement and social cohesion. And I'm wondering if you have any comments about the success in actually getting departments to pull together in a more unified fashion.
Acclimatising myself to federal government departments. Karen? could be a lifetime. But I guess I'd make a couple of general comments. Again, part of what we're doing in trying to prepare for the development of a national anti-racism strategy is to basically say this is a policy of government, and its intention was that this would operate across government, and there are various, you know, different strands of that one way or the other. So we will try to push it in that way. But I think one of the challenges is around the issue of leadership as well. And in some of the preliminary consultations that we've had around the development of the strategy, I think it's fair to say that people despair at the level of political commentary around, well, particularly around the issues to do with immigration. And I guess what's not said about, you know, some of the other issues, including, as I mentioned before, issues to do with what's happening with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander policies and so on. And so it means that whilst in one respect, you know, there's an opportunity for race to be looked at in a very proactive way and for government departments to rise to the challenge, and you might argue that there are, you know, the levers are poised to be in place appropriately, of which the anti-racism strategy is a small component. The other is that we recognise that we're in a very, challenging political environment as well, where race is also being used as a bit of a political football one way or the other. So I haven't answered your question because all I can say is that we're going to give it a go. And I think that's evident in the Victorian context with particularly, you know, there is a framework in Victoria with the Human Rights Act and the Equal Opportunity Act, which does impose an obligation on government departments to operate in a certain way. And I think that was a very good question for the Auditor General, because that act still remains. But without the kind of leadership to promote it and really say that this is something that's, you know, intrinsically going to make us better at what we do, it's very hard for government departments to actually know how much energy to put in it, as you well know yourself.
Okay. No. And right at the back, Joe, gentleman with the brown T-shirt. I think this will be the last question.
I'm really interested in that definition of racism as a practice that reproduces inequalities because of race. If we take that as the problem, the solution towards the end of your presentation seemed to be about more individual practices. So things like encouraging empathy, encouraging contact with disdained groups, encouraging difference or a celebration of differences beyond a negative concept of otherness. And I kind of noticed that's a shift in scale from the structural to the individual. I wanted to ask, what steps would you recommend as ways of of tackling racism at that structural level in terms of the unequal outcomes it produces?
Thank you for that question. I think I kind of gave you a very short synopsis of some of the recommendations, because some of them are structural as well, but I was just pointing out and indicating areas where the individual can act as well as being really important. I think structurally some of the things that we've hinted at already, that it is, we do need to take into account, you know, what the leadership is doing. We do need to advocate for good policy and develop good policy in those areas. We need to get institutions and organisations to understand what institutionalised racism is about. We need to unpick and dismantle racism in those very senses. And that we perhaps we need to move to a point where that we recognise that at some point cultural differences need to be taken into account of, but we should be looking towards more mainstreaming of all services so everyone can see that there's a value there. So there are lots of different things in terms of structurally what can be done, but I think that's, unless Helen wants to add anything.
Well, I mean, it might be a good point to start to go back to the first question or the first comment that was given, and I think it's a number of different things. The most significant thing that can happen, in my view, in the next probably 18 months is if we actually go to referendum on constitutional reform, because that will go some way to redressing some of the past that has been talked about in terms of our First Nations people. And the second thing I would say is that what we do with our anti-discrimination laws at a federal level is also critical. And that means recognising, which I think the Victorian law does, I've forgotten, Karen, but recognising that systemic discrimination or institutionalised practice is actually a form of discrimination which impacts as well as the individual experience of discrimination. And what we know is that because any form of discrimination is about power differential, we can't rely on individuals to change the system by bringing complaints. Very few people actually feel strong enough or brave enough to actually go through that process. And I would just reiterate that the anti-racism strategy is a small part of those bigger issues. And what we can do is, I say, shine a light on where racism occurs. So my final comment is, please fill in the online survey and make a submission.
Sorry? Yes, we'll need to get a microphone to you. But then we will finish after that.
Well, I think this is a discussion we have to have and should continue. Because from my personal experience, I went to Europe as a Commonwealth employee with a Commonwealth passport. And they doubted that I'm an Australian. This is the image Australia have outside. If you are not white, you are not Australian. And this didn't come from anywhere. My second experience was when I went to Northern Territory in Darwin, at Darwin Hotel. I was staying with few American visitors came to visit CSRO, and I was accompanying them. I was the only black man sitting with them. Then from that pub of the Darwin Hotel, few Aborigines were sitting on the corner. They were waiting for me. I went to the toilet and they called me. They said to me, where are you from? I said, from Africa. Straight away they said, Shaka Zulu, which was at the time the movie. So there is disparity, that there is mistrust. When I go to back to Northern Territory, and I have been going there for the last 20 years, whatever discrimination here, I see it as periphery compared to what those Aborigines are living. So this discussion has to go and address the basic roots of this racism. Those people deserve so much of this country, but they're getting nothing. So for me as an African coming here asking for more, when I see these people not moving an inch, and generations after generations not going anywhere. So I think this has to go right deep into the system. There is a system failure. It's not about people. It's about system that has been taking this for years and centuries. So I think it is better for us to look how do we untangle this system and give these people a light of the day so they can walk like any proud Australian in this land. And then the world will see us from that light, that any black man or black woman or any colour of this country is an Australian. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that comment, which I think is an appropriate closing remark. Thank you. It only remains for me to remind you that there will be a reception just out there. You can either go through that door or you can go through that door and walk the way around. But please do stay if you can and join us for whatever fabulous food and refreshment we've got there. But before we do that, I would like to say a huge thank you to Helen and for Milsom for giving us both so much to think about in their presentations, but also for contributing to the discussion so fully. Thank you very much.